podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Friday show, Neil Atkinson with Chris Barber, Kev Walsh and Teza Simakulwa to talk about the Premier League action as it comes. We're going to have Billy Grant and Michael Bailey on the phone. Billy Grant talking about Brentford. Brentford play Friday night. Should we get Billy out the way? Absolutely. Here he is with Harriet Pryor.
And I am now joined by Billy Grant for the Besotted Brentford podcast to look ahead to your game against Watford this weekend. You've been a bit up and down with results recently. You had a good win against Everton, a loss to Tottenham and then a draw to Leeds. It feels like that's all happened in a really short space of time. How are you feeling at the moment about Brentford and about how the team's direction is going?
Yeah, I'm still feeling cool. Thanks for inviting me on as well, by the way, Harriet.
No, thanks
and the Anfield Rep people. It's not a problem at all. Like I said, I always enjoy coming on to your show, which is all good. But anyway, but listen, you know, thick and fast, if you want me to throw in a cliche here and there. And the games are definitely thick and fast. I am I'm in a blur at the moment now. I've got no idea what games have been played in the beforehand, which games are coming up. They're all over the place. But let me just sort of cast my mind back. Sunday we went to Elland Road. We had a great journey up there. We had a great day up there. I have to be honest with you, I didn't expect anything from the day because we played Tottenham a few days earlier. Yeah. And we have to admit that we didn't turn up, because that's disrespectful to our team to say we didn't turn up at Tottenham. But when we went to Tottenham, we were really flat. And Tottenham, kind of like new manager, they had the weekend off because of the snow break, and they came at us with a little bit more kind of verve and punch, and they were up for it a little bit more. And we just seemed flat. And it looks like the injuries, but also the schedule had really hit us. So when we came away from there really flat with no points. And thought, oh my God, we're going up to Leeds a couple of days later. And obviously Ivan Toney was then announced to have had COVID as well. So we've got Ivan Toney out. We've got, you know, Aya, who's our main central defender, out. We've got Raya, who's our main goalkeeper, out. We've got all sorts of players out. We just thought absolutely nothing is going to get anything up at Leeds. But we were really surprised how Thomas Frank turned it around, and he just changed it up. Sergi Canos took him, at the ex-Liverpool player, took him from right wing back, put him sort of kind of this sort of attacking midfielder role. And he put sort of, he actually put him up front with Brian Mbeumo, who played the Ivan Toney role. And first half we were all right, but the second half we were on fire. And, you know, to be honest with you, I was a bit gutted to have be 2-1 up against Leeds, who are giving us absolute dogs abuse. Like I'm saying, at every angle, they really were. And they were loving it. And then we went 2-1 up and they were foaming at the mouths. They were absolutely apoplectic. Like, you know, they couldn't stand. And they got that last minute goal off the Bamford in the 94th plus 1 minute. And that was a bit of a gutter, it has to be said. But at the end of the day, I'm going to say another cliche. I would have taken a point up at Leeds in the first minute of that game. So it was good. And we also beat your rivals Everton as well a week or so before that as well, which was a terrible game, a terrible game of football. What we just needed the points. And we came out and we actually we got the point, Ivan Toney penalty. Like I said to you, we've had serious injuries, and I know everyone gets injuries, but they've hit us quite badly, and it's really wrecked the way we play our football. So we're not playing the football the same way as when we played Liverpool a couple of months back, when you came to us and there's a brilliant ding-dong of a match. We're kind of grinding results out at the moment now until our players come back. But the Everton game, we got the result that we needed, get 3 points on the bag. I have to say, at the time, Everton were, and this is not a disrespect to Everton, I'm just telling you the truth, they're probably the worst side that we had played this season when we played them. They looked devoid of any energy, any confidence, just anything. And I know this can change in a month because it's the same that happened to us. But at the time they came to us, was probably a good time that we played them. So coming back to your question, how am I feeling? I know we've got a good side. I know we've got good players to come back. Shandon Baptiste came back on Saturday, scored his first Premier League goal. He's a great player. Ivan Toney's going to come back soon. Aya's going to come back in the next month. You know, we're going to probably buy someone in the window. So I'm still confident, you know, that we'll be okay.
Yeah, you will be okay, I'm sure. And the games are coming thick and fast, like you said, but you've got Watford this weekend. You currently sit 4 points above them in the Premier League, and that's quite a big gap, actually, in terms of league position. So I think they're in 17th at the moment. I think you're sitting in 13th. But 4 points isn't that big a gap. So it is a big game this weekend, but you surely must be thinking this is one that you can win.
I'm not taking anything for granted, not in this Premier League. Don't forget, we played Norwich a few weeks ago and they came to us with 0 points, I think it was, or 0 wins and a couple of draws, like, you know, and it was a banker as far as everyone was concerned. And we were like, all of a sudden, you know, we might Brentford ourselves right up, and we Brentforded ourselves right up when they came down and they got the 3 points. And also we went up to Newcastle and everyone said, you'll get the points up there as well. But Newcastle actually, I thought, played really well when we played against them. So we're up front, they're up there, very good. In defence, they were terrible, like we were terrible as well. So 6 goals in that game as well. So I'm not taking anything for granted with Watford. What I will say is that we are at home, which is a good thing for us, even though we've only won a couple of games at home. We're also playing Watford, who are great up front. You know, they've got a couple of strikers, which are great. Luckily, Ismail Sarr is injured. You know, he's like, you know, when he puts the buns, when he puts the burners on, that geezer is like, he's like Bugs Bunny, you know. So is Bugs Bunny fast, actually? I'm not sure. You know, probably Roadrunner more than Bugs Bunny. But anyway, you know, but so he's not playing, which is good. But they've still got a decent strike force, which we need to watch out for. And because our defence has gone from the top three or top four best defences in the country to only to one of the top four worst in the country, we have to be careful about that. But we know that we can score goals. We can score goals with Ivan Toney. And Watford do have one of the worst defences statistically. Again, if you check out our podcast, prideofwest.london, we've got the spreadsheet Winker Will on there. And he tells us all the stats, and he just tells us how Watford have, you know, statistically one of the worst defences in the Premier League. So if we are on our A game, we just need to basically make sure we actually put our chances away, which is something that we're a bit guilty of not doing at the moment. Create chances, but don't put them away. So if you put them away and keep ourselves tight, it's not rocket science, is it? We should get something out of this game.
None of it's rocket science, that's the thing, but it's harder than it looks, isn't it? Is there any team news? Will you have Toney back this weekend, or is he still going to be out?
No, Toney's got COVID, so he's out with COVID. Obviously, you know that Tottenham their game's cancelled tonight, which is Thursday night, because of a massive COVID case. And obviously, we played COVID last Thursday. So we thought all of a sudden, you know, the conspiracy theories in the Brentford fandom said, hold on a second, did Ivan Toney get COVID from the Tottenham players? And then we stopped them before, actually, no, he couldn't have done, because the Brentford players didn't get anywhere near the Tottenham players in that game. So we reckon that it must have been the Friday or the Saturday we'd have got tested. So in 10 days, he's going to be out for this game. But we're keeping our fingers crossed that he'll be back and he's well enough to play in the Man United game, because we're playing Man United on Tuesday. So that's the big one for us. Yeah. All the other players, like I said, Shandon, and also your ex-boy, Sergi Canos, who, like I said to you, unfortunately, his restaurant, we found out the other day, we were going to go there. We booked to come down to Liverpool in the middle of January, and we were going to book to go to Sergi Canos's restaurant, and we found out it closed down 2 years ago.
Oh,
so we're really
gutted
about
that. That is gutting.
So Sergi Canos, he is out because he always picks up these really silly yellow cards. Like, he does yellow cards for sort of kicking a bit of grass or sticking his tongue out of the referee or something like that, you know. So he took his shirt off when he scored against Leeds, because I'm going to be honest with you, that everybody, Pontus Janssen, Sergi, Thomas Frank, everyone absolutely wanted to beat Leeds on Saturday, and they scored against Leeds, and we went ahead against Leeds, and they were so happy. He took his shirt off and he ran around all over the place, and he got a yellow card for it. So he's been suspended because he's on the sort of kind of, what is it, 5 or 6 or 7 yellow cards, whatever you get for getting suspended. So he's out, unfortunately. So we're going to have to rejig our side once again, which we're quite used to, but we'll see how that goes.
Another rejig. It's the first time, I think, that the two teams have actually ever met in the Premier League, which feels a bit mad, because obviously your history in the Championship and everything. But have you got any score predictions for me before I let you go?
Ooh, this is a difficult one. I just realised.
Don't worry, I never get them right, so I don't. No pressure at all.
To be fair, actually, I actually got the Leeds prediction right when I said 2-2, which I think is pretty spot on. I think we haven't got a clean sheet in us at the moment now, except against Everton. I shall move on. So I've got to put at least one goal in there. I would like to think that we've been learning from our mistakes, and I would like to say that we're going to go for a 2-1 win for Brentford, but that's me again, you know, trying to keep out, because we've got Man City coming up and we've got quite a few difficult games coming up. So I think let's get it. Man City and Man United are coming up in the next few games. So I'm going to try and keep myself up, keep Brentford positive, and try and keep ourselves in the top half of the table if I can. So fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. I presume you're going to be there at the game as well.
haven't missed a game home and away this season. Even Stoke City on a Tuesday night, I was there. And amazing. I'm going to probably go to Port Vale, which is probably old school. That's like Brentford old school, like, you know.
Amazing. We're going to be sort of
doing the old school thing. So loads of Brentford fans are going to go up to that because they think, I can't believe it. It's going to be like a novelty playing Port Vale as opposed to Man United. So that's going to be fun. Good fun.
Amazing. Well, best of luck for this weekend. And thank you so much, Billy, for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on. You bring a great energy that we all need on a Thursday and a Friday.
Okay, thanks, Harriet. Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.
Excellent stuff there from Billy. We'll let you enjoy Brentford versus Watford under your own steam as and when on Friday night, maybe in between going from bar to bar on a Christmas night out or something, one eye on the telly, being accused of being antisocial. We've all been there. We will move, though, to 12:30, where Manchester City play Wolverhampton Wanderers. And Kev, let's be honest, we all expect a Manchester City win, but Manchester City hate this sort of thing. Do Wolves have it in them?
Yeah, well, they showed against us that they 100% do have it in them, don't they? But City haven't got a div or a league either, so they could be up the creek. The other thing that goes in favour of this one is which game of the weekend do you never bet on? You never bet on the early Saturday one, do you? Because it's always the same. So Chelsea last week against West Ham, that was the early kickoff.
Yep.
There's something about that spot that causes games like this to be an issue, a thorn in the side for bigger teams. Wolves have obviously, they won there a couple of years ago, they didn't need 2-0. And this season, City have had a couple of games, Southampton and Palace being the ones, where if they don't break the deadlock early, it doesn't come at all for them.
In terms of the time, both 12:30 and the time on the pitch, I think is a big deal in this one. In that if City just sit here and they're 1-0 up 12, 13, 14 minutes, then it's very difficult to see a way back for Wolves. They can just have the ball kept away from them. City will be really patient. But it's one where I get the impression City could do their own heads in. If it's not working for them, and they'll begin to remember, they've had this before, they've dealt with the Adama Traore before, who Bruno Lage has talked about this week, saying he wants to get more out of as much as possible. He was threatening against Liverpool. I feel as though it's one where the clock is very much Wolverhampton Wanderers' friend.
Yeah, it could be, but based on midweek's game against Leipzig, Pep actually called it a training game. He said it would be a really nice training game for City, which is a bit disrespectful, and then they went and lost. But
it's a mad red card to get in a training game, by the way. To get yourself knocked out of a last 16 game to get that red card is really weird.
I mean, exactly. So I think what Pep will probably have done with his team is prepared them more so for this game rather than the Leipzig game. And he rested quite a few players. I think, you know, Cancelo, Sterling, Bernardo, all the key players that have been playing really well this season have all they all missed out midweek. So I think City, as long as they don't overcomplicate things, because we know Pep has a tendency of swapping and changing formations for no reason. As long as they play the way they have been, I'd expect them to go and win against Wolves.
You would. One of the reasons why, one of the things that I think has changed for Wolves, Chris, and watching it in person last week, Jimenez completely understandably has not quite come back the same. And I think it's, as I say, I'll say it is completely understandable. What he's gone through there is something. But he just looks still, he looks short of a lot of sharpness, a little bit in places. He looks like he's lost a teeny bit of pace. He's moving into his 30s anyway. But I think it's the worst time to get that sort of injury that's just took him out of so much contact football.
Yeah, I remember head injuries. I remember when Petr Cech got his. And actually, there's something about the gear you have to wear that you never forget about it. You never move away. You know, Aaron Ramsey's not necessarily wearing a brace on his ankle when he comes back and stuff, but you've got your gear on your head, and you mean you never forget about it. It's never, you know, you can feel it all game. And I think there's something latterly of strikers actually getting better about 30, like proper strikers. Yeah. Your number nine sort of like coming into a bit of their own, and the Lewandowskis, even the going back a bit, Drogba's, Van Persie's.
Giroud as well.
Yeah, 100% Giroud, and there's plenty of them. And I think it's a real. And I think you mix that in also with a new manager coming in when the old manager was so a thing and so consistent and so week in, week out. And obviously Jota leaving was obviously less felt by Jimenez because he missed so much of the season. So that was those two were clinical. They were so good. I remember watching them against, I think it was United in the Cup, and it was just a laugh. It was just so good to watch. And I think they've lost a lot more than you can really account for, because there's this like new, there's some new names in there, there's some new faces, kind of a new formation. So I think it's easy to forget, A, how bad they were last season and how sort of lost they look, and how much is new.
They came into the game against Liverpool Wolves, haven't had the two games in a week. They haven't got that against City. They've got the week off. I take the City training game points, but there is this idea that you know, Wolves themselves, they haven't just gone through a 90 that they could have, that was in the balance till the very end, the 0-0 that they'd had the game before. Because they do tire against Liverpool, they fall further and further back on themselves, Tezza. I do think that that could work for them, but then the flip side of that is they were at Molineux, they had all the adrenaline of that big game against Liverpool. This one is, it's at the Etihad, and it'll not offer the same sort of, the same vibe.
Yeah, I think also with Wolves, what they can probably, you know, take advantage of is, like you're saying, they're away from home, so they can, I think I've watched them a few times this season and they've countered very well. Trincão's been very impressive when he's started, but I think Jimenez has like cemented himself as the number one with Hwang on one side, and Adama's come back into the team. And as Kev said earlier, a few seasons ago when Wolves went away and beat City, Adama was the key player and he was transition, he was the out ball. It's like every time Adama got the ball, it was like five man on one, but then what would happen is the rest of the City team would be disorganised, and one through ball, I know it's sometimes asking a lot for Adama to play the right ball, but one through ball and one of the other forwards for Wolves would be in on goals. So I think that would probably be the game plan, to maybe try and isolate Cancelo. And then
I thought you saw against West Ham for City, Antonio gave Laporte a torrid time, and I think that again is, that offers you a little bit of a blueprint. Stone starts midweek, I'd expect him to start Laporte. That gives, you know, if they can get Traore in that channel, and that's where he likes to play, I think he can make Laporte's life hard.
Yeah, definitely. I think especially with it's Semedo plays wing back as well. I think he gets up and down the right hand side very well, and they can almost double team that area from in between Laporte, and because Cancelo's really an important player going forward, so there's always space in behind to dominate.
The key man for City at the minute, Cancelo's been it in the past, is Bernardo Silva. It's mad he's only got 7 league goals, Kev. It's a real reminder with footy, like at times it's gone on, I think, for years, where players have looked as though they're linked to go away, and then from nowhere they suddenly become absolutely integral. You know, all summer it was he wants to move on, they're happy to move him on, someone's got to meet the price tag, and suddenly he's the most important player. He scored 7 goals.
Yeah, I think the reason for that probably comes down to the fact he definitely wants to leave. I think it's more to do with weather than the actual football, isn't he? Like, he's not that comfortable in our climate or whatever. But I think
he's comfortable enough to be brilliant at football.
But he's thinking, fuck it, if I'm here, I might as well have a go. Like, what he's thinking is probably, well, there's no number nine, so there's no, like, we don't have to have a focal point around somebody else. The way they play now is all about having 6 number 10s on the pitch at any one time. And he's the ultimate number 10, isn't he? I don't just mean for City, I mean probably for anybody. He's a fantastic footballer. So he's probably looking at that pitch thinking, I can go wherever I want here. Literally, yeah. I wouldn't mind betting that Guardiola says to him, do whatever you want, lad. You can literally do whatever you want. Everyone has got some sort of semblance of having to do like a job, but I bet he's the only one with the freedom. And he makes the most of it because he's an absolute magician on the ball. He's strong as well. And he's so game. Do you know what I mean? He's not one of these number 10s who's a bit like, oh, I'm not sure if he fancies it. He's got that niggly nastiness to him as well. So he's an all-round great player, and hopefully he's playing for someone else next year.
The only thing I say is I think it's hard to underestimate how badly Tuesday went for them. Like, it's great to say that and then come out of it, but they were really poor. They were really predictable. They had quite a good 11 out. And then obviously, I don't think Pep will have dealt well with the following days and the application stuff. And that could get in their heads in a really negative way, I think. In, like Tezza said, like the overthinking, the over-application, the you know, dropping somebody to make a point, or however that plays out. And I think Wolves are the opposite, where their game actually went quite well, apart from the obvious, but it went well until the obvious, and there's a lot to go on from there. And there's a lot to be like, you know, City against Leipzig looked pretty unthreatening for a lot of the game. So I think, I don't know, I don't think it's a foregone, but I think
there's a way, when you, the way you're talking there, there's a way you can see exactly what we want to happening.
Yeah,
so 100%. If Wolves and all we needed was another 30 seconds into Liverpool, so if we just do the same thing again, and if City are feeling a bit like, oh, what did we do in midweek there, it only takes to get to 10 minutes and people start going, what's going on here? People might start trying to force it,
and they're less dynamic than you.
Well, that's it. You get to 20 minutes though, and people start, heads are falling off, not just on the pitch, in the crowd as well, and hopefully Guardiola. So there's definitely a world in which you can see them not only dropping points but maybe even getting beat.
The top and through the Champions League group top, they've gone out of the Carabao Cup, but it can't go that much better. They paid $100 million for a lad in the summer. I feel as though you can't call him a flop because you're top and you've gone through your Champions League group top. But I feel as though if Guardiola quite likes someone to bang a brace against Wolves, it would be Grealish. I think he'd probably like... That's where I think the Leipzig thing doesn't go well for him, because so much of it's going through Grealish. Yeah. But he's not imposing himself anywhere near as much as I think Guardiola would like him to do. I think this is just a... When someone's as good as City and they've got the resources of City, Teji, you're looking for, not even necessarily for problems, but for potential problems down the road. They could do with getting a little bit more out of Grealish sooner rather than later, I think.
Yeah, I think what Pep's probably realised when he brought Grealish in is that he's probably a bit more of a different player than he probably envisaged. I think, obviously, at Aston Villa, he was the main playmaker, so everything went through him. And he was able to start on the left and drift central, and anything good Villa did, it went through Jack Grealish, whereas... At City, especially when you're an attacking offensive player in the midfield, or if you're playing a forward line, you've got to share the ball and you've got to share possession, and your role is coinciding with someone else's role. So he's at City, he even came out and he said that like he thought he'd be able to get into more positions to score more goals and get more assists. But what really has happened is he's actually had to become a bit more disciplined, and he hasn't got that freedom to drift wide and then come inside, because you're going to... Because he more time than not, he likes to play on the left, and Foden plays from the left. And if Foden's not playing from that side, you've got Cancelo behind him. So he's almost like, well, what do I do? There's two other players who do what I do best. And he's had to play, I think, false nine a couple of times, and he's not used to playing that high up and then dropping back in.
There's some of the, like, want away son sent to like military school, like Francis Markham in the middle. He's a bit like, do we not have a laugh at it? are we not allowed to put fireworks in the bin? Can we not do that? And I think there's also a thing where you sort of go, you've signed a player and then you're going to coach him to be less of that player, and which is okay, but then why? You don't need that particular player to do that. I think you can level someone up rather than sort of restrict them.
Do you think one of the issues is this is a thing, I think it's a thing for Liverpool as well, don't get me wrong, and I think it could become a thing for Chelsea. They've spent 100 million on a lad. If you wrote down all of their players in order of how good they are, he probably comes seventh, if you're maybe being generous. Mm-hmm. And that's... But he cost 100 million, and he cost 100 million for a reason, don't get me wrong. He cost 100 million, maybe they overpaid a little bit, but he cost 100 million, but he's probably the seventh best one.
He's a bit of a solution looking for a problem at times, I think, when you watch him on the pitch. Like on Tuesday, it was just a bit weird how he was almost coming in to shoot and then being like, oh, I'm not meant to shoot, and laying it off to absolutely no one and just passing it to Leipzig centre-back and sort of like, it was quite odd. It was quite a weird performance, I thought.
Type of player will be ruined by that. He's the type of player that does not need overcoaching. He's the ultimate street. Like, he's obviously not a street footballer. Like, I bet he grew up in their academy, but he plays like that. He plays like he's been playing with his mates all of his life. And he doesn't, as you say there, who's he laying the ball off to? He's what, 24 now? So for the last 15 years, he's gone into that position and he's just slammed it past the goalie and gone, look how good I am here. Mm. And he's looking now thinking, if I miss this, he is going to go off his head. And half the time, I don't even know what the fuck he's talking about.
That's Kevin De Bruyne. Yeah. I mean, he's not thinking like, that's John McGinn. He's really good, but not Kevin. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see which way that develops. But I think we're all ultimately saying City win, but City win with a little eye on it, where people might be texting each other that's about the hour mark, saying City switch win. It on, aren't you?
No, that early game, it is not the one, especially after the Champions League. So I'm going to go for at least a draw.
At least a draw?
It's not a foregone. I wouldn't be surprised if it's like a down to the trenches 0-0. Obviously, it stinks to play this out.
I think City win, and I don't think Jack Grealish will start either. I think he will go with Sterling, Jesus and Foden, and that will just stretch balls. And
see, when you say it like that, it sounds more like a City win.
We've all talked ourselves into something, and talked us all out of it like that.
You can tell the three who are clinging on to a title race.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the one who's looking up there going, no way. As long as I'd rather they won it.
All right, Chelsea Leeds, 3 p.m. Well, there we are. It's all a bit sticky all of a sudden, Chris. Weirdly, like, it's almost come from nowhere. I think the Burnley draw is weirdly the one, not too similar to sort of to a couple of Liverpool results at times this season, when you sort of look back 4 or 5 games going, I wish we got a different result in that one. We could accept and understand the others. The Burnley draw, like, looms large. 2 more points. Everything feel a little different at the minute. It's just got a little sticky, and you're not quite sure where certain people fit in.
Yeah, I'm gonna go now. I'm gonna need Tezza to lift me up in a minute. Because I was watching the game last night, and I was sat there thinking, is it the stage now where I was going back through our recent results and just goals, not results, so performances and goals, and I was starting to think almost all of them are just the individual doing something. I wouldn't say, we started talked about the wing backs being so effective maybe like a month ago, and me and Mo were like, but that can be a tactic, and it can. But you're watching, and again, the reason that I remember the Grealish thing is because last night, four or five times, both Werner and Lukaku do all the hard bit, sell the dummy, come inside, and then think, oh, I better pass it. It's like, no, but the other players think he's pulled off for the shot. He's not even in the market for the pass. And so, and like I said, the Mount goal, the Reece got the James goals at Newcastle, they're just quality individual moments. And they're not, you know, you look at, and then Lukaku's goal, I don't know if anyone saw it last night, was actually a really nice bit of play where, like, Barkley and Werner just turned it on pace-wise, and then it just stood still, and they're in the box completely on their own, the two of them. And you think, how are we in early December? And I know there's been injuries, but how are you still looking like one of you was signed yesterday? And it was like, we've played, do you know what I mean? It's like one of them's a transfer deadline day and we've got a doozy at home and we're just like getting them out for the fans sort of thing. And like I said, it is, I was just annoyed yesterday because I'm thinking, obviously we've lost the entire centre mid, and that would do anyone and stuff. But it's not even that. I still think we can be compact. I still think we can keep clean. Ironically, we can keep clean sheets. We can do better than we have. But it's the fact of, we've not lost. Our attackers are all fighting fit and are all flying. But we just don't seem to be building any sort of attacking plays or passages of plays. And it makes you start to think what's happening on the training ground. What relationships are being built for on the pitch? Because at the moment, it's just about either give it to Mason and he'll do something fantastic, or one of the wing backs will sneak at the back post, or Pulisic will come on and just look busy, and I don't know. And like I said, I was going through the goals and thinking none of them are really a move, or like, you know, we've got that massive Arsenal 2009-14, just like the arc of frustration around around the edge of the box, and it's just like a rainbow of grey, and it's just knock it in and knock it there. And then, and what you have in effective teams is one player, like happened last night, just turns, just goes up again, just goes quicker, and the defenders have set too much into the arc of frustration. But it's just, it's not happening. It's quite frustrating at the moment to watch us just kind of do nothing for 90 minutes.
Do you think it's because he's got them so drilled in terms of that shape? And the thing with that shape is it can leave you, I always think, it can leave you with an attacker light. You've got to have committed something. You've got to gamble something somewhere on someone. And it doesn't even matter. Like the last night, the theoretical wing backs were Hudson-Odoi and Saul.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are midfielders. Hudson-Odoi, attacking midfielder, frankly, winger. He's playing wing back. But you've got to find a way that a 3-4-3 is actually, at the very least, a 3. And in attack, you know, you need the 3 to all be present and correct and quite consistently, and even, you know, not even doing a lot of the share of the work. I never look at a Chelsea side under Tuchel and feel as though they didn't graft. They all look like they're working very, very hard, but it's the one more body.
For me last night, it was that none of those back three became a midfielder at any point. And I think that's a big part of a back three. That's what I've always enjoyed it. I've said it before. That's a formation. I think if you get it right, you can just fly at teams and it can be really exciting. But if you get it wrong, then they've got like a Sabutio game. It's like they're not allowed to leave the line. They're literally on poles.
For one of your defenders to step out there into the midfield, though, you need real wing-backs. They're not wing-backs. You just said they're Hudson-Odoi and Saul Ullardi. They've never been up. They're not wing-backs.
We had Reece James centre-mid, so I guess the theory was that it's a bit more fluid than that. But it's a bit of a hope and a dream, isn't it?
Every time someone says the player's name there, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Why is he playing there? Reece James in centre-mid, and you've got Callum Hudson-Odoi playing wing-back.
James played there for Wigan quite a lot. For some, Loftus-Cheek's on the bench, though, which is odd, because he's been tailor-made.
I think he was saving Loftus-Cheek for this game, because all your other midfielders have like gone down.
And he was tailor-made for last night. But ultimately, I actually think the finishing first in the group's been slightly over-egged, ever so slightly.
I'll come back to that in a second, but the all your other centre-mids have gone down, but Sal was playing left wing-back.
Yeah, but he's been absolutely
weird
in centre-mid. it's odd.
What an adjective, weird.
It's odd watching him play there.
But it is.
It's like, remember when Piano Man turned up on the beach and no one knew who he was? it's a bit like, who is this bloke? Do you know him? But he's fucking really good at football, but just not, I don't know. Maybe he's got like this, he's got a really like, sort of niche version of what Silver's got, where he just hates the middle of football pitches in London. And that particular climate, near the touchline, he's happier, but that particular climate in the centre of a field in London, fuming, not having
it. Is he going to get Jorginho back? Is he going to just get him on the pitch against Leeds somehow?
I think you can protect a Jorginho, and you can kind of put not legs around him, but he's so, I love him, he's so intelligent and stuff. I imagine, you know, 70% Jorginho is probably probably worth it. But then
probably perfect for Leeds in a sense, yeah, in terms of let them harry, let them press, and he'll just find little pockets and little turns.
Yeah.
Do you think Tuchel should change formation when all his midfielders are out? Because I've seen like debates on like Twitter and stuff.
I extend that to other managers too. I mean, I think Liverpool last year could have considered it. I think that the formation that was picked for Chelsea was the one that he arrived into and thought, right, the best thing to do with these boys is this, and it did pay off. But it's probably not all of their form. Like we just said, he's now clinging on to wing-backs that neither of them are wing-backs. And the theory's fine, but he keeps on bringing on Pulisic quite late to be a left wing-back. Just change it up. Don't be a wing-back. Put Aspilicueta at right-back or whatever. Or just, like you said, adapt and look at the players you've got, because there is, whether there's a 4-4-2 there, there's other formations within that. We've got loads of fucking players. Like we could lose six and still have quite a lot and still full of boss.
Yeah, I think the issue is that you've got a lot of players, but a lot of them aren't good enough for Chelsea. I think what has happened over the years is Chelsea, especially when it comes to buying attacking players, they buy a lot of players based on reputation. So Werner's had a good season, let's get Werner. Lukaku, he's just won the league with Serie A, 28 goals, whatever, 10 assists, let's get Lukaku. But realistically,
Havertz is massively in that conversation as well.
He is. I'm not going to start on Havertz because I always mention Havertz and too many people on Twitter come for me.
I like it.
Chelsea fans come for me.
I think he's great. I think the problem with all the players you've just named, I think they're all really, really good.
But not for Chelsea.
But well, no,
they're all good individuals, but there's no team.
I don't understand how they all play for the same club. So I think they're all really good and you could make loads out of any one of them, but I don't understand how they're all playing for the same club and all probably on unbelievable money, and they've all had more than 60 million quid paid for them.
But they're all doing different things too, genuinely. Like the wing backs are putting in good crosses, and it's like Lukaku has a particular run he likes to do, and the crosses, the amount of times our wing back crosses to our other wing back in a game it's odd. It's weird.
It's been working this season though, hasn't it?
I think that's where the individual talent comes through, and like I said before, Havertz is like a millennial Berbatov who like vapes. I just think he is. I think he's great. You can imagine him just sitting on like a sort of like bus stop vaping doing kick-ups. But I just think it's frustrating though. I know he's rushed, he's been injured, but we shouldn't be relying on what we're relying on to win games. And you can see when the opposition get a bit of a win, get a sniff of what they need to do or get a goal out of nothing, we then just become quite desperate. And I don't think you need to, like you said, you can just change it up and sort of 20 minutes is quite a long time.
I think it's going to be sounding a bit controversial, but Chelsea's best from three that you've had over the past a few years is Callum Hudson-Odoi from the left, Tammy Abraham through the middle, and Mount playing narrow on the right hand side. I think all Chelsea's players that they bring through the academy have shown they're better than all the signings they brought in, and they spend 50 million on a player, and then it's like, well, let's give Callum Hudson-Odoi or Mount a go, and it's like, actually they're better than every single player we've signed.
And I think Lukaku could still work, but it's like they've never met him. So I don't know, it's quite odd, that thing, because he will score.
He needs to play up front with someone. I've seen it firsthand at my club. Lukaku up front on his own is not the same player as if you put someone alongside him who can, he can play 1-2s with, and they can make like little runs in and around. Different player.
Maybe the answer is Lukaku and Havertz.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Close together with maybe Mount behind.
Mount behind maybe.
Mount behind. But then what you'd see a lot of sides just going dead flat against that and saying, we don't think you're running past us with the ball. We don't think you can. You know, Mount's got a lovely touch and so's Havertz, but there's not one obvious lad who's going to have a ton of pace there. So sides can either choose to push.
That's not happening with those lot now.
It is interesting.
Are we shit? Can we not?
No, you're not shit. You're really good.
I hope
you're shit, but I don't think you are, because I think the other thing is that ultimately I think that you're more than capable of just basically ensuring that the football match happens where you want it to happen and the opposition don't. It's then how that becomes, but it's in their box, and that's the bit I think that's the finding hard. And the other thing that's difficult is, like, does there need to be a wide Kante conversation that this fella's able to basically be a one-man midfield, but he's only available for honestly 25% of the games at the minute, feels generous.
Yeah, latterly he's not been there at all, has he?
If you do that much running, though, it's going to take a toll on your body.
Yeah. And for year in, year out, and have that burden put on no one helps him. when he plays, no one helps him. He helps everyone else.
He does more running, that's 25% of the games, than Kai Havertz done his whole career.
It's true.
What I sometimes wonder about Charles, though, is I sometimes think that the plan upstairs is always longer than the manager, and we are going to have to move players on. Is it a case of you know, have a quieter year. Like, you know, these injuries, and it's the physios are advising the upstairs or advising him or whatever to just be like, you know, we need Kante. He's got a new deal and stuff on the horizon, or he's already signed it. Or he signed it latterly. And I do sometimes wonder if Chelsea, because there's some long-term planning, but it seems to be very like in boardrooms rather than in dressing rooms.
On that, I think there's a really interesting thing this season where I think it's fair to say the Liverpool squad and the City squad are very much clicked into a we need to win now mode. And I think I think you're seeing that certainly in the way the Liverpool players speak after matches, and there appears to be a real sort of we're all in this together. There's two seasons, this one and the next one, and we all need to win now. That's who we are, and that's where we are.
It's a bit the last dance, isn't it?
Yeah. Whereas the weird Chelsea thing is there's a few lads who were quite key. Silva, Azpilicueta, Alonso, Kante. Jorginho's 30, just had a big year. Mendy's 30. I know he's a goalkeeper, so it's a little bit different. But where I feel a bit like the winning's almost just all a little bit done. And then the other side is there's a group of players who are very much in the, we're going to be in our win now years in three or 4 years' time. There's not that many who are in that sort of slap bang, 26, 27, 28, 29. Yeah. We've got to have it now, who are really important to the club. And I just wondered about that. Like, I'm sort of looking at Chelsea at the minute, and even the manager to an extent, he's got the credit in the bank of the European Cup. He could retain that very easily, certainly if he gets Kante fit for big games, he could retain that very easily. And then from there, then he could basically win back-to-back European Cups, be able to then go to the Chelsea boards. Well, next year's our year. Next year's our year. Yeah, these lads have all need one more year. And that'd be my overriding concern. More than anything else you've said, I think from a Chelsea point of view for the league this year, is it very much feels like there's a lot of footballers and a manager who can maybe be thinking, next year's our year, not this year.
I think you're right. And I think the league conversation has been externally applied rather than it's not we like you said, our players aren't coming out with big statements. You know, I do think there's been even the fact that, like you said, loads of those players like getting rotated, like Azpilicueta, you know, the skipper, there's a new identity sort of happening, I think, coming out of Chelsea. And I looked at my notes for the last time I was on. Sometimes I write notes, Neil. I'd actually written, I think Chelsea are in danger of being decent for quite a long time because of, you're looking, yeah, even around the rest of the league, because you do lose Jorginho, but then you bring Conor Gallagher back. Or you lose Kante, Billy Gilmore pops in. Yes. All right, guys. I'm not going to do a Scottish accent. And again, I mean, there's centre back links that we didn't bring in and stuff, and I think the Silva is such a Chelsea signing, and that it will pay off and it makes sense, but it's not forever. But I don't know. I do think there is that conversation, but that's where, again, we really hate December, and Tuka could be gone by January, and I.
You can come to United if you want.
We'll get to United in a minute. We've got Michael Bailey coming to talk about Norwich, but I want to do Liverpool also 3 o'clock first. Liverpool versus Villa. Steve Gerrard, legend. Kev, hope he gets beat 20-0.
Yeah, 30-0. I'd be more than happy with that. I don't think it's likely, though. I reckon we will win, but Villa are playing really well, and he doesn't suffer fools gladly, does he? And I think the players are sort of, they're realising that. The atmosphere will be boss. Be absolutely, do you know what I mean? A legend coming back, which is great, but also we're flying at the moment as well. So everyone gets to be really nice before the match. And obviously, if a ghost hits up, maybe he doesn't get clapped off the pitch then. Well, he probably still would. But it's nice to have legends coming back to the club while we're flying, because in the past, they've come back and you're like, yeah, it's fucking great, this, but we really could do it with it, so we can get in the UEFA Cup. Whereas this time, it's like, we probably will win because we're fantastic. And we get to say, yeah, Steven Gerrard, we want you to do a boss job at Aston Villa, so in 3 or 4 years' time, you can come and win the Premier League with us.
But we've just won 30 now.
There you go.
It is...
He might retire if you do that.
I think he'd redouble his efforts. Knowing Steven, he would redouble his efforts. It's a strange thing that, you know, obviously, when this sort of thing happens, Tezza, you've got to, everyone's got to keep everything in check, but ultimately there'll be a couple of people around Liverpool who've worked with Gerrard, played with him, Henderson being an example. But actually, and I mean it with the greatest respect, he's a little bit irrelevant to Mo Salah. You know, he'll have watched the videos and all of that sort of stuff, and I think he can, you know, they're obviously the people who are on the pitch, and simultaneously there will be, you know, Liverpool are looking to win things. The Gerrard aspect of this, I think, could be a little bit overplayed. But the one thing you would say is that if you're an Aston Villa player, you know, a really good way to get in this manager's good books and stay there is to be great at Anfield.
Yeah, it is. And I think one player that's thrived so far is John McGinn.
Yeah.
I think he scored like maybe 3 in the last 4 or 5. And I think what I've noticed when I've watched Villa play under Gerrard is they play a lot quicker and there's a lot more compactness in their team. And there's a lot more verticality. Oh my God.
It's easy for you to say.
you know what I mean? Yeah, passing. A lot more of that and a lot of quicker from back to front. And I think giving McGinn a bit more of a license, I think against whoever they played last, I think he
Leicester.
Played Leicester. He played slightly from the right and he was able to roam. He's brought in like Jacob Ramsey as well to play. And he's got Louise alongside Nakamba. So there's a lot more of a structure based in the deeper areas of midfield, which allows them players to get forward. And I think what's happened is all the Villa players have realised, actually, you know what? We're kind of playing in the image of Gerrard. This is how Gerrard probably liked to play, where he had Mascherano, Alonso, or whoever it was behind him in his heyday, and he was allowed to play quick and vertical passes forward and get into the box. So
they look strong to me. Like, you name that three, Nakamba, Louise. Louise can just play as a pure number six on his own. I mean, Nakamba, Louise and McGinn, these are robust footballers. I think this is my concern from a Liverpool point of view. It isn't that Liverpool can't find a way just to run away with this game. I think they most definitely can. But if they get stuck in a bit of a dogfight, it's a Villa midfield that will not roll over. They're gonna have to outplay. They have to match this level of fight to this Villa midfield, don't get me wrong. But then they're going to have to outplay them. Liverpool, I think, can sometimes end up facing up against midfields where they can just outfight them, and that'll be the end of the matter. I don't think they're going to have that luxury against this Villa side. They're going to have to rise above them rather than go through them.
It's a Villa team that I would say was comfortable with the ball as without, which isn't a good thing. Go for you going into this game, because I don't think that they won't shit the bed at any point. I think I'm not a huge fan of all the back four, but like you said,
do you mean Mings?
Yeah,
we all mean so. Mings.
I didn't want to say.
I reckon Gerrard, if you asked him in his quieter moments, would admit he's shite.
Yeah, I didn't want to sort of dig him out there, but yeah, him.
I don't think he listens.
Maybe he does.
Sorry, Tyrone.
or Stephen.
But I think the other one is the Martinez. He'll love it. I think they'll fly into it, and I think it could be one of those quite mad games, quite exciting games. I think you could see Villa going one up, sort of just by sheer over application in the first 10 minutes, and then maybe that actually changed the game enough for you. But I think the longer it goes on, they just get more and more fight and more, whereas you get more and more frustration and more sort of worries and things. And yeah, I think it'd be a really interesting game. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm really pleased that it's likely to be Ashley Young left back next to Tyrone Mings centre half on the side that Mo Salah plays football, Kev. This is my, you know, the thing that I think gets Liverpool through the game is that it's just that simple fact. That all down the... Now, listen, Louise will play that side probably as well, but Liverpool's right-hand side there with Arnold, with Salah. Buendia has been playing more from the left as well, and I think Buendia is the sort of player who can be bypassed in a game like this more than the midfielders I've just discussed. I think if that right-hand side's pairing for Liverpool, which it has been...
You might as well give Young his yellow card now.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah. Get out of the way.
Yeah.
Get out of the way, let him bypass it. You know, you've got the... I think that's where the game will be won and lost for Liverpool. If those three are absolutely flying for Liverpool, I think that there's... I don't think Villa can cope.
You could have any centre-half and any left-back though, couldn't you? Or any full-back anyway, and have Mo Salah in there, and it's time, you're thinking, wow, what can they do to stop him? So the fact that they are probably what you would perceive as to be their weak links just make you think, yeah, that you could see their shape being ragged all sorts of all over the pitch. Midfielders having to drop in to try and sort of put fires out. And the second you start losing your shape against Liverpool, especially at Anfield, we'll just kill you, because once one of them midfielders drops in, that's exactly where Trent will just find himself in the middle of the pitch there, either score himself or a nice little ball through for someone else to do it, or Mo just dances around and does it on his own. Villa are a good team, there's no doubt about it. They've got a good manager and they're in a really good moment, aren't they? They're playing well and they're fighting, but Liverpool at the moment are Liverpool. We're flying. We've had a few ropey results this season, but it feels like we've really just clicked into gear. And listen, you can be made to look stupid on shows like this, but I'm not thinking that there's anything except a Liverpool win. I'm probably quite a handsome one, I think.
Okay, spoke to Michael Bailey from The Athletic. Well, I didn't, John did. He was, as ever, absolutely wonderful. Great company. Is John and Michael chatting about Norwich City.
And yes, it is John Gibbons with Michael Bailey from The Athletic to talk about Norwich City. And it's exciting at the bottom, Norwich. Well, it's exciting at the bottom generally, not just for Norwich, but for everyone. It feels like there's a top three, which is quite interesting. And then there's a bottom sort of, I mean, I don't know how many you think, maybe seven or eight, which is very exciting as well. Maybe a little bit too exciting. Norwich have had an interesting month, but so have lots of other clubs.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose for Norwich, it's exciting if we're involved in it, because ultimately the last thing we wanted and what we were probably fearing was being completely cut adrift at the bottom and it all being over by, well, before Christmas. But I think Norwich being in the mix is certainly one thing that would be good to continue. They've got a few difficult fixtures coming up, so got to be a little bit wary of that. And likewise, some of the progress they have made under Dean Smith, it's been tentative, and they are playing so much of a degree of catch up because of early in the season. But it is a really interesting picture at the bottom of the division. I mean, I find it quite hard to find three teams that are completely worse than Norwich. Whether they get sucked in and you know, fall apart is a different matter. But I think it's going to be quite a fluid situation, I must admit, over the rest of the season. You don't know what Newcastle's situation is and how that's going to develop. Can Brentford really stay so far ahead of the relegation zone? Well, potentially, because they've been pretty consistent so far, but you never quite know. So it's going to be really fascinating to see how it pans out. It always is. And I have no doubt someone will end up getting relegated to who really wasn't banking on it. And then it becomes pretty torturous for them as a club.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a good team will go down, and it'll be interesting to see who it is. And every time you feel like someone's going to get dragged in, Alan Everton, they get a big win. And so it is sort of really interesting down there. But as you say, interesting, I guess, a good thing for Norwich, because it means you're sort of there. And an interesting tie on Saturday, Manchester United at home. We've had their own interesting few weeks. I feel like I've said interesting more in the last two minutes than I have in the last 2 weeks. But anyway, United come obviously with a new manager. So a fixture maybe a couple of weeks ago that you thought, well, we might sort of do something there, suddenly looks a bit trickier.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating one. That, I mean, it was really, to watch United at the weekend and how close and small they made the pitch and the pressure they put on. But then, what it took for them to actually win that game, it made for a really fascinating dynamic. I know they've got a Champions League game coming up, obviously, as well. But
yep,
how Ralph Rangnick sets them up away from home will be really interesting. I mean, the difference Norwich have got this time compared to 2 years ago is that they're going to have a full house. And that can make Carrow Road a pretty difficult place for the bigger teams to come when the floodlights are on and
yep,
all the usual cliches. So Norwich have got the potential to make it quite difficult for United. And in truth, it's kind of scoring goals that Norwich are really struggling with. Defensively, I know they were a bit sloppy against Spurs, and I think that was unfortunate. But I'd like to think at home they will be a bit tougher. And so it'll be quite an interesting examination of how United go about it. Are they really going to be that proactive and try and condense the pitch that much away from home where the crowd will be on top of them? Maybe. But whether that will be their playing to their strengths, I don't know. And that might give a few gaps for Norwich potentially to exploit. But I mean, ultimately, Norwich will be happy if they take a point from that game, I'm sure, unless they're like 3-0 up with a minute to go. So we'll see how it plays out. But I think Norwich will be looking forward to that challenge where they've got not got really anything to lose at home again and with a full crowd. So it should be a cracking atmosphere at the very least.
Yeah, I'm going to watch it. I'm looking forward to it. Just for everyone knows at home, we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, so we don't yet know what happened on Wednesday night. So if we're not talking about Ronaldo's horrific injury or whatever it might be, then that sort of is why. But from a knowledge point of view, you mentioned before, Michael, that it's tentative improvements, the tentative steps under the new manager. So what sorts of small things have you seen already that the manager's done?
Yeah, so I think if I look back to the Liverpool game at the start of the season, there was mitigating factors, but there were issues there that I saw from Norwich 2 years ago, which is they were pretty easy to score against in transitions. They were quite open, and you could kind of sit there and wait and know that Norwich would give you an opportunity on the break or in a certain situation if you win the ball, and most teams would be good enough to take advantage of that. Liverpool certainly were. So I think what you look at Norwich now, they are much more organised in those transition situations. They seem to be able to recover the positions better. They're working a bit harder in defence, if I'm really honest. It's sometimes just as straightforward as that, and they look more organised as a team. So that's been a real positive. Also, Dean Smith has sort of looked at games, and I hadn't fully appreciated this for while he was Aston Villa manager, I must admit, but he seems to be quite proactive tactically in terms of if there's an issue on the pitch, he'll look to find a way to resolve it. He'll tweak things at halftime if he needs to. And these were really coaching things that weren't particularly happening under Daniel Farke, who I think was a great coach when given time and, you know, a plan to evolve. But in the actual game-to-game, match-by-match challenge tactically that you get in the Premier League, I think it was a little bit lacking. So they are things that definitely improve Norwich and what they're capable of achieving and being competitive. But equally, you know, scoring goals is probably the remaining issue. And he is trying to find ways to deal with that. But that might just come down to personnel at the end of the day. Well, we will have to see.
Might he have some money available in January, or, you know, is he going to have to be a bit creative with loans?
Yeah, so I don't think there'll be much money. I mean, I could see them maybe getting in a loan player from abroad, because they've already got two domestic loans, so they could potentially do that. They spent a lot of money in summer, and they can't really then spend any more money, especially given they've had to pay out compensation to Daniel Vargas instead, which they wouldn't have banked on either.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, Dean Smith is currently assessing the squad. He said he'll have a meeting with Stuart Webber over the coming weeks with how he sees it and what they need. And he'll have a good handle on what they'll need to stay up. At the moment, it's hard to think he wouldn't be looking at it and going, we need more goals. So it might come to the point where they have to do something like that and see if they can find someone that can at least add a bit more to them at that point. But obviously, that's still another six games away at least. So we'll have to see.
We'll have to see. Just to finish up on Saturday then, will it be similar sort of squad available to the manager that went to Tottenham, or is there any sort of ins and outs in between?
I think it'll be similar. The only one who may come back is Matthias Norman, who has had an injection in a pelvic injury. So they're hoping that they can manage that and he will actually be available. Losing Milot Rashica for the next 5-6 games is a real big blow, because he'd been doing well. He wasn't available for Spurs either, I think it showed, nor Newcastle. But other than that, they'll have to go with what they've got, apart from Brandon Williams, who's obviously on loan from Man United, and he'll get to watch the game from the stands, I suppose, which would be good for him.
Bessie in the house, I'm sure they'll look after him. And one of those nice little blankets for when it gets cold and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Michael, top man for coming on. Thanks very much. Michael J. Bailey, if you want to check him out on Twitter, he's also writes for The Athletic, as I said at the top. But The Athletic are good, aren't they? Check them out as well. Michael, thanks very much. Back to the main show.
Great stuff from John and Michael there. Manchester United then up against Norwich City with a football manager, Tezza. Heady days, crazy times. It's already noticeable, I think, a little bit of differences. And I think you've got to be careful not to overstate. New managers have bounces all the time, all the obvious sort of hits. But the fact of the matter is that there's a number of players, there's every chance this is really good news for Manchester United, and I suspect most of them will be under 24.
Yeah, I just can't believe it's taken United this long to find the manager who played similar to how Sir Alex Ferguson played for like 25 years or 27 years. You know, let's get the wide players in a half space, two up front, and control the game and press the opposition in their zone and in their half and try and sustain attacks. That's what made Man United successful for like nearly three decades, and then we just Alex left and it was like,
they used to manage you, yeah.
That's what it feels like. But yeah, and one of the key players that has almost been given a new lease of life, which started in the Carrick, was Sancho, and he's played from the left and he's played from the right hand side, and obviously he's come from Dortmund, where Dortmund play possession based football, and he's a player that knows how to press from the front. And what it's almost done with Ranić, even though he's only been in for like two games, it's almost said to the players who thought who were undroppable and thought, I'm always going to play, no, actually, you know, there's two or three players who can play in your role. Whereas when we played with Solskjaer, it was a 4-2-3-1. It was Bruno, doesn't matter what state you're in, you're playing and starting. But now it's actually like, well, we're playing two players in behind the two strikers. If you're not doing well, we're going to play Sancho there. Probably Pogba not. But if he was available, Pogba would play there. And now we've got options to play Ronaldo, Rashford, Cavani and Greenwood as strikers as well. And even Donny van de Beek's getting a game. Just hopefully we can realise that McTominay's not a footballer and he can sit on the bench for a bit longer. But until that day happens, then I won't be very happy.
It's interesting that he's ended up, I mean, you know, Wan-Bissaka obviously has had a little bit of a knock. He's ended up very quickly with Dalot and Telles at full-back. I've wondered whether or not he might possibly end up shunting McTominay out there at some point as well.
That's my hope.
That's your hope?
That's my hope. McTominay right back.
Sounds like a yellow card to me, that.
At some point, he's getting tucked in, I'm thinking.
I just heard that Ragnick said at one point, he says, Scott, you're not a footballer, sorry.
see, what it is when he plays for Scotland, he plays in a back three and he plays right side of centre-back in a back three. And it's almost like, I mean, Scotland have got decent players, Gilmore and McGregor and a few other players are playing midfield, but it's like, well, how do you play for United in midfield and then you go to your national team and... Surely, out of not being good enough to play in midfield for your national team, you have to play as a centre back. So I think the issue with United is Matic has no legs. He can only play one game a week, and the only other player we have is Fred, who's had a resurgence. So it leaves McTominay to play in the pivot, because when Van der Beek plays there, he still likes to get forward a bit more than the other players, who are a bit more disciplined. So I think McTominay isn't a bad footballer, but he's not anywhere near the standard of a United, a Chelsea, a Liverpool. I think why people don't really have a go at him is because he speaks very well. You know, he's come through the academy. He's someone who listens to tactics very, very well. But when it comes to playing in a pivot or playing in a midfield for a big club, you need someone who's going to be confident and brave and put the foot on the ball. And when you're getting pressed, you know you can pop it to him because he's going to knock around the corner and get the team playing. But McTominay, he hides a lot. And I don't know whether that's out of lack of confidence or he just knows he's not that player and he's not good enough to do it.
If you had to pick one out of him and Fred, who would you put in there?
I like Fred. I'm quite
like him because he plays Man United. He's absolutely dog shit.
That's what I mean, I felt quite proud of him when he scored.
I would pick Fred just for the simple reason he's not a coward like McTominay. Like, generally, if you watch United play, the amount of times where the ball is on, where you just need to swivel and look forward and pass it forward, and McTominay will go backwards or sideways. It's like, if you just swap McTominay for not even someone who's like world class amazing, you put someone like Douglas Luiz, like we mentioned before, United go up two levels just because you got a competent midfielder who's not scared of turning and passing it forward.
Isn't the funny thing though that whenever I've seen McTominay, the bigger the game, the more involved and the more risks it looks like he takes. Like, the faster the game's going. I wonder if there's a thing with him where he's been stuck thinking about it too much under Solskjaer. Because, I can remember some Manchester derbies where United are trying to play on the counter all the time. So the job is move the ball forward into these channels, put it in, do it quick. He was doing it then. Because I quite like McTominay, but I only see him in the big games. You know what I mean? I only see him when I choose to watch Man United because they're playing, you know, I'm opting in. So a lot of the times when I see McTominay, I'm like, he's very involved and he's doing this and he's doing this. And then every now and again, I'll catch him in the sort of game you describe. And you are right in that it then becomes a little ponderous. And I wonder if he's almost best left with time. If you sort of know what I mean. Like, if you don't press him, he'll end up thinking his options through to, well, I'll pass it back to Lindelof. If you see what I mean, rather than his option being, well, I've got no time here, so I'll just go and hit him, bang, and I've hit him.
I think what it is with him is he's very good tactically. So in those bigger games where United probably have less of the ball, and it's like, well, your job is to close down, hustle Harry, and as soon as you get it, that the out ball's on. He looks very good because in those bigger games as well, the opposition we're playing against are going to push and press, and there's more space. If you drop a shoulder and you're driving at the opposition. Perfect examples against Leeds. Anytime McTominay plays against Leeds, he looks like Bastian Schweinsteiger from 15 years ago.
He had some really good shots.
He scores 25-yard screamers because there's lots of space and Leeds like to man mark. And he's best when he runs into open space. The issue is when you're at a top club, a lot of teams, either they press you really, really aggressively or they give you time and space and you have to break the lock, and he's not the type of player to do that.
Do you know what this conversation reminds me of? Jordan Henderson 8 years ago. I reckon you could sit and have a discussion. I'm not saying McTominay will go on to be as good as Henderson, because Henderson's been unbelievable. But there's a lot of the things you're saying here about saying he doesn't want to go forward, he doesn't want to use the space. That was all getting levelled at Jordan Henderson 8 years ago, and 5 years ago, and probably 3 or 4 years ago by some people, know what I mean? He had to turn into like the ultimate midfielder before he got any credit. And it's just, that just popped into my head there. Is there a conversation to say that maybe take Fred out, buy another midfielder, and like let him play with someone who actually knows what they're doing in that midfield rather than someone who's running around like, looking like they're carrying a bomb?
When was he last coached? Mourinho doesn't coach players anymore, and picked him as his player of the season to prove a point. And then Solskjaer came in and just made him watch VHS of the treble win over and over again. So I think that player, we've talked about it, when he's down on his instincts, he's better. The minute he has to think, and I think he could be someone who actually comes out of this well, this new management, this new sort of direction of football.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue with United, all the midfielders need someone else to sit
yeah,
deeper.
That's about to say.
All of them like to turn and play on like a bit higher up, whether it's counter-pressing like Kante or it's running to open space to attack the box. And we lack a player like Fabinho, like Jorginho, Loftus-Cheek, who can sit deep and get it off the back and then allow that midfield partner to push on. And he's suffering from that.
Well, I think this is the funny thing about where United have ended up, despite all the investment, Tezza, with the possible opportunity, you know, if you want to stick with, not that it will necessarily happen if the manager goes upstairs and someone else comes in, but if you want to stick with 4-2-2-2, mm-hmm. I'm all right with the second to last two, whatever United's options are. I can go, well, all right, you could do something with Fernandes, with Sancho, with Van der Beek, you could drop Rashford back in there. There's little bits and pieces where you can make it up. Everywhere else, I'm going, they could do with someone else. They could do with someone else at centre-half. Who would make the other centre-halves look better. They could do with someone else deeper in midfield, who'd make the other midfielder look better. Mm-hmm. And they could probably do with someone else up front, who would make whoever the other forward is look better. And that would be what would worry me, is all the way through that spine there, I'm going, these are all right players who you could get a tune out of, but they all need someone else who's going to make each of them look better.
Yeah, which is quite worrying, because of the amount of investment you're talking about, 80 million on Maguire, and you're 52 million on Fred, 500 grand a week almost on Ronaldo, and whatever Cavani does, because he doesn't play football anymore, he's just on holiday at the moment. And you're thinking, you've got all these players who are massive name brand players, but they all need one more to play with them. And it's like, who is making the decisions and the recruitment upstairs? Because it looks like each season United look like, oh, we're one, two players away. And then because we don't win that season, it's like, well, that player who we needed to make us one, two players away is now older, and now we need two or three more players.
And that player in the meantime has maybe just lost a little bit of edge because he's not had the players around him. And I think it's a really difficult, it's almost a little bit of a Rubik's Cube in terms of solving it, where everything just doesn't seem like it's going to quite click into place anytime soon. And it's very easy for us to say this on an Anfield Rap podcast, but that is sort of what I look at United, I'm like, unless maybe Varane sorts the centre-half bit out, maybe.
I think he does. I think when
who plays with him?
It's still Harry
Maguire.
See, I'm not Maguire's biggest fan, but the difference is when you play Harry Maguire next to Varane in a team that's going to press and be on the front foot, and Maguire's doing all his football with the ball, he becomes a player who's 10 times better than he is. When we're doing the, you know, let opposition have the ball and we're trying to transition and there's big gaps for us to like break from defence to attack, Maguire looks suspect. He looks like Tyrone Mings, but right-footed. That's what he looks like. And it's like, why have you spent 85 million on a player who's not good enough to play for you? But I think what will change is two midfielders who play in front of Maguire and Varane, and no other investment in other places. Well, maybe right back. But apart from that, again, that's another one. 50 million on Wan-Bissaka, and you can't really play football that well. It's just terrible. Anyway, two midfielders, as I was saying, and I think the team goes up a level because Man United's midfield compared to all the rivals' midfield is quite laughable.
I agree with that. I think you say about it being a Rubik's Cube, it could be one of them Rubik's Cubes where you just make two turns, you go, well, I've done that there, you know. Yeah. And it's like United are always dangerous. They got that. Yep. The attacking talent is an absolute embarrassment to riches, isn't it? But if you get a couple of midfielders, they could be flying.
Ryan next a year, doesn't he? Do you not think? Do you think he stays on a year next season?
I think it depends, because I think
too deep, maybe. Go on, sorry.
No, I think it might suit everyone for him to make the move upstairs with the knowledge that he's just got in the very, very short term of working with all of these every day and being able to really quickly go, right, this is where we're just putting a line through this. It's not a project. This player's not a project anymore. This player's not a project anymore. Let me go and sort all this out very quickly and let someone else then sort of deal with what I'm doing and just focus in on. And he can give them like a great brief, just sort of know what I mean.
Yeah, I just wonder if that person's out there.
Well,
that's the much bigger question. I think he might be like, I'm still the best option, even if it's just a year and we wait for someone to make a decision to step away. Because and Ten Hag, like when he came to Champions League group top, was like, I'm loving it. And their director of football, I can't remember who it is, it's the next player.
Svensa.
That's the one, yeah. Svensa's on an extension and it's just not interested. And he's the obvious.
See, the thing is with the Ten Hag links, I think I remember seeing an interview from Van der Sar. He said, there's only two teams I'd work for. And he said, Ajax are one and the other one would be Man United. So if it came to almost how like Van der Beek was signed through Van der Sar saying, go to United, you know, you can make something. I think if it came to Ten Hag and it was like, well, you've just won another Dutch league, and I mean, you probably won't win the Champions League, but Rangnick's ahead of you in doing the recruitment. Why don't you just try United? Because if you fail now in this situation where United seem to have a few more like people in the upstairs.
Grown-ups.
Yeah, yeah, grown-ups. It might not be seen as your fault and you still might get a chance of going to another big team because it'd be like, well, United are awful anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's not your fault. Come and manage us and then all of a sudden you just flourish again. So I think that will be the target, actually. I think Ranić, I mean, United at the moment, I think we're getting like four or five staff members from Jesse Marsh, apparently. He's just been sacked by Leipzig and he apparently he's going to come in.
Is
as
he?
Apparently he's going to come in as one of the assistants at Old Trafford.
Yeah, he's doing it. He's brought one of the lads who's worked at
from New York.
The New York lads who's worked at the Red Bull clubs before. So
and
I think
he was
just
the manager.
Yeah.
Which is a bit like, how are you getting all these? So all these managers are getting sacked, but they're coming to be his like assistants. And I'm thinking,
it's like a father's adjustment.
No, but it's a bit not too similar to Kieros coming back to United when he took a managerial post and then came back to work under Ferguson. It's not too dissimilar.
But it's a big difference, though, to have actual managers who've had experience and thought, oh, it hasn't worked out. Let me be an assistant again. And, you know, I can almost grow my reputation again whilst United are growing their reputation where instead of, let's get Carrick and Fletcher where they've just retired.
That seems to me, though, that they're thinking that's too much. I don't know the American fella.
Yeah. Chris, what's his name? Yeah,
he was the manager of New York Red Bull. He's just recently been sacked, and then United have brought him in.
I think it's unlikely that he'll go on to be manager of Man United, but that who's just been sacked by
Leipzig.
Do you know what I mean? You could see a perceived path where he goes, well, I'll work with Ralph Ranić, I'll be the manager and I'll just do this, you do that. Then it's that looking a bit more like a team, doesn't it?
Yeah, because especially before Ranić left Leipzig, I think I don't know whether he worked with Marsh, but basically
he was a part of the Red Bull family because he was at Salzburg, so we'd have known him, worked with him in the past.
So there's kind of been a succession previously, so that might be something where Ranić's actually like, well, I've prepped it for 6 months and you take over for like a year and a half and then there's someone else on the radar. Like
an understated appointment would actually suit you for a change right now. Do you know what I mean? Someone who doesn't get a big Twitter announcement and everyone's just like, all right, let's see what happens.
Let's play some games of 14 and try and win them. Just dead quick, because we've talked about that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What quickly, Norwich is a perfect game in a sense, as Young Boys sort of was, as a chance for them to look at a few. The one thing I would say is that, and the biggest winner, I think possibly the biggest winner, you mentioned Sancho already, and I think he's in there as well. But I wonder if the biggest winner from this is eventually going to be Greenwood.
Mm.
If you're going to play two up, I think there's no excuse, frankly, not to be finding ways to get Greenwood on the pitch on a pretty regular basis, just when it looked as though he was beginning to lose first team opportunities.
Yeah, the only issue with playing Greenwood, because Ronaldo will start more time than not. When he's fit, he'll be the first striker on the team sheet. The only issue with Greenwood and Ronaldo, it might change because now we've got a coach, we've got coaching ideas, but when Ronaldo played with Greenwood in previous games, it was a bit like, well, I'm going to show you how good I am, and the team was like almost tailored to give it to Ronaldo, but Greenwood was like, no, I'm on the pitch, I'm shooting from every angle I can. But I think now maybe with a bit more of a plan and players closer to each other, they're not going to have that kind of, you know, I'm going to show you who's the best player. So I think Ranić was talking about Greenwood just as, you know, he basically saying like his ceiling's unstoppable and as long as he keeps on developing, especially physically, he'd be unstoppable.
Going to beat Norwich?
Yeah, I'm hopeful. They've been playing better under Dean Smith recently, but yeah, I think it'd be tough.
They couldn't do anything other than that, did they?
Yeah, it's true.
All right. If we're honest, Sunday's a bit rubbish. I mean, with the greatest respect, Brighton-Tottenham might not happen, which could be an interesting game, but it may not happen for understandable reasons. And then you're looking at the rest of them, and you're a bit like, there's not a standout sort of fixture. Everton are playing, though, which is always good to see. They're playing Crystal Palace. It's a bit of a funny one all of a sudden for me. Crystal Palace, Kev. And there's a lot of, everyone's admired Crystal Palace over the course of this season, but they've now only won three. They're actually below Everton in the league. This will be the 16th game of the season. They've just lost three on the bounce. They could very, very, very much do with beating the Blues, going back above them this weekend.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I think will happen as well. I think Everton, they beat Arsenal the other day, and he played all right. He played a lot better when the substitutions have been made, unfortunately. But it was a win that the... You could probably say they deserved, but they scraped it. They very much scraped it. And I think there was a massive sense of relief. There was a lot of celebration around it. And I just thought, that's not what they need here. They need to just be thinking, right, that's it. That's the kickstart. Where it felt like there was a lot of, whoa, we've done it there. And Crystal Palace is not a team you want to be walking into. You need 100% focus on them. They've got some fantastic players. And I know they've only won three all season, but you can very much see what the plan is there. Mm. I don't think they're in danger of getting relegated this season.
No, I don't think they are. But
I think Everton might be.
Well, I think I think Everton could still... It's a horrible little run for the Blues, to be honest with you. If they don't get something from Palace, the fixtures that follow that they've got is they find themselves away at Chelsea, at home against Leicester, and away at Burnley, and then at home against Newcastle. In that if they do, for instance, take 0 points from Palace, Chelsea and Leicester, suddenly Burnley and Newcastle feel a bit six-pointery. Mm. It's worth saying, Chris. But the flip side is, while I sort of agree with everything Kev's just said, especially around Palace, you can see what the idea is, etc., etc. One of the ideas has to be winning games of football. And they appear to have just found that a little difficult all season, no matter how well they've done in long patches of games when I've seen them. It's like you just need to make sure you're winning. Arsenal away being the best example of a game that should have been won all day by Crystal Palace, and they conspired to throw it away.
Yeah, Palace they're a little bit of just been a really good idea, and sort of like you enjoy watching them, and I do enjoy watching them, there's really nice players, but like the United game, I just thought they were just fairly anonymous. They didn't really like, you really notice them. That could have been against anyone. I don't really remember many moments. You know, I thought Zaha was kind of going back. Benamani was going back somewhere. And yeah. I thought he'd love that atmosphere, but he didn't really get much out of it. I don't know. I think Everton are so much. I think Everton are all right. I think that they
are. That's not what we're here for, Chris.
But I mean, demonstrably, from your point of view, they're not all right because he battered them. But I think, just like I said, watching them, like loads of their games, it's just thick moments of just absolutely done them, and they haven't been able to like rally and go again. And I'd kind of disagree slightly in that I think that moment should be as big as it was. It should be a bit Klopp against West Brom. It should be a bit like, fuck it, this is what we do. Mm. We're not a team that goes away at Brentford and stinks the place out. And I do think,
they've got to back it up though this weekend.
Just as a performance, like I said, but it could be glorious failure. It should suit them well. But at the same time, I do think that what they need is to be a functioning machine when they do get their players back. And I think Andre Gomes looked really,
he was the difference maker.
I think Gray and Townsend are both fine, really well applied. Coleman, I thought Coleman's interview was fantastic. It's just a shame for him that he can't do it on the pitch that well anymore, and he just looks a bit out of place. I'm a big fan of Ben Godfrey too. I honestly look at that Everton team and I think they're not as shit as I think we can kid ourselves sometimes. It's funny because it is funny, but yeah, I don't know. So I wouldn't be shocked to see him have an all right December following.
I think with Palace, what has happened with Palace is they've tried to rebuild. They've got like fresh players, younger players, players that fit an identity. And Vieira likes to play the 4-3-3. But what's happened in the last three games that they've lost is Anderson's missing at centre back, and Tompkins has come back in. And all of a sudden, they've lost three games in a row. I'm not blaming it on James Tompkins, but...
That Anderson pass, though. You know what I mean? The pass he plays constantly is so effective.
Yeah, exactly. He's one of the key players when they're playing out from the back. And also, what's happened as well, who I think is criminally underrated, James McArthur. He hasn't played in the last three games. And Jeffrey Shillup's come in. And Gallagher's moved from playing... Instead of playing right side of midfield, left side of midfield. And the balance isn't the same. So I think Palace are one of them players where... You get their 11 out and they'll give anyone a game. You take one or two players out and it's like, it works, but it's not exactly the same.
This is why I think, I take your points and I agree with a fair bit of it, but this is where, what he's not quite done yet is weeding them off Benteke and Ayew.
Yeah.
That Benteke and Ayew are back in as well at the minute and they're playing every single game. So he's got Edouard who could come in for Benteke. He could bring Elise in for Ayew.
Eze's fit again.
So in midfield, for instance, I'd bring Eze back into the heart, and I'd just gamble on him in the heart of the midfield against Everton. The idea that we're going to commit to entirely what we are, but I understand why he's not done that, because I'm saying this is me doing the big project talk, and I'm the one who's just been saying he's got to start winning some games of footy. And Jordan Ayew, I can understand how if you're a manager you end up in a situation where you go, well, I at least know exactly what Jordan Ayew is going to do.
He's Lucas Moura.
Yeah, he's going to just do that. He's going to be fouled over and over again. He's going to scrap for every single ball. He's going to miss a good chance at some points, but he could be around when we score.
Yeah,
and I think it's hard for Vieira at the minute, because he's got this. I think he's got the idea of these other lads who could come in, the younger players, and commit to them entirely. But I can still understand completely why you pick Christian Benteke, because he's going to win your headers. Yeah. And a lad who's going to win your headers is nice. It's nice to know, well, he'll win us some headers.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's hard for Vieira.
I think, especially with Benteke, it's like Palace need a Benteke mould player, but an upgrade. Someone who's a bit more reliable. Almost with Edwards finishing, but Benteke's physical output of winning. Who'd you say?
Callum Wilson.
There you go. Callum Wilson or Calvert-Lewin. If you put them into Palace, they're like a top 6-7 team, but it's one of those type players aren't going to probably go to a Palace because either they're already playing for a better team or they cost a lot of money. On Everton, I think they're quite awful, to be honest. I'm not going to lie. Like,
That's what I'm here for, Cedric. Fuck you, Chris.
Like, I watched them play and I think, you know what, these players on paper, they're actually good players. And then I watched them play and I'm thinking, they've got Benitez in, who I think is a fantastic coach and manager, but I think this is a Benitez for a Premier League 5-6 years ago. And it's Everton want to move forward, but they've gone backwards with the manager. And it's Benitez will probably be here for the season. And what will happen is Benitez will probably leave, but then they'll have to replace a Coleman, Delph, Alan, Gamamin, and it'll be like a recycle all over again. And Everton will just be...
Rinse and repeat,
because they'll try and... They'll go for Martial or they'll go for a player who's at a big club.
Martial is so heavy.
Yeah, he's awful. They'll try and recruit a bigger player from a bigger team who's not really doing it, and they'll just continue the cycle.
Okay. Excellent stuff on the Friday show. Thanks to Billy and Michael and Harriet and John for doing the calls there. Thanks to Chris, to Tessa and to Kev. It has been your Friday show. As I say, if you want to watch the Blues at R4 on Sunday, but you could choose to do something else, there's a full weekend. There's a full week of football to follow all the way through. You've got to pick your battles at this time of year. Sports Social Podcast Network.